I'm off on assignment in Washington, D.C., but before I left the studio yesterday, I sat down to have a difficult conversation with a doctor who, as doctors often do, found himself witness to a medical decision fraught with ethical ambiguity and emotional pain. And the pain from what he saw a long time ago has stayed with him for his entire medical career. Dr. Frederick Newman is the director of the Anxiety and Phobia Center at White Plains Hospital in Westchester County here in New York. But when he was a medical intern, he saw a baby born with a single fused eye in the middle of its forehead. Parts of its brain and skull were missing, and the child's esophagus had never separated from the trachea, making it unable to eat. It's a rare disease, fatal. It has a clinical, unpronounceable name. And so in the medical community, this rarity is called Cyclops Baby. Dr. Newman recently told this story in a blog post for Psychology Today entitled The Cyclops Child, and he picks up the story of the original incident more than 50 years ago and the extraordinary reaction he has received from sharing that story with the world.
I came into this experience a few days later when the baby in question was transferred to a pediatric service. I think in order to make this come alive, I really have to describe the baby. It's a grossly and grotesquely deformed child with an eye in the middle of its forehead made of the two fused eyes. No nose, head that was missing part of its skull and a considerable part of its brain. What I imagine happened is the obstetrician took one look at this baby, recognized it as a child that was not going to live. And I think what he imagined, what he planned on doing, was sparing the family what would have been, in my opinion, an extremely traumatic situation. He anticipated probably that the patient would die in a few minutes or a few hours. That's what usually happened. And he told the parents that the child had died, but the child hadn't died. This child had other abnormalities other than the ones I mentioned. The baby had an esophagus that went right into the lungs so that there was no way of feeding it. There was never going to be any way of feeding it. We knew this child was doomed from the time it came onto the ward. But while we looked at the child and it was quiet, it was easy to sort of ignore it, frankly. It didn't look like a human being. But when it started to cry, it sounded like a human baby, and it tore at everyone's hearts. And the child continued to live without any sustenance day after day.
Over the course of how many days?
Over the course, as I remember, of about 13 days. It seemed greatly enlarged in my mind because it was such a terrible experience for everyone.
You, over the course of your medical career, came to have some judgments about what the doctor, the obstetrician, did in that initial particular case. Explain to me what you initially thought, how you came to maybe another view, and why you decided to share this story.
What I thought initially, holding that baby in my arms, is that the obstetrician had done the right thing. In those days, the expectations patients had coming into the hospital were somewhat different. And I thought that there's no question still in my mind that this woman looking at this child that had just come out of it would have been traumatized permanently. Now, a lot of people who have read the blog just can't believe that. An experience like this is so out of their experience. And one of the problems with the people relating to this post is that they see it sort of as an extension of their own experience, naturally. Mm-hmm. What do you do with a sick child? What do you do under certain extreme circumstances? And none of that applied. And I wasn't able, I think, in the text, and I don't really think it is possible, to make come alive the fact that there was nothing that could be done for a human being that we were holding in our possession and in front of us and trying to help in one way or another. It could not be comforted. It could not be fed. It could not be calmed. All we could do, short of killing it, which is something I thought about doing.
By myself.
That was the kind of thing that you couldn't involve somebody else.
At a dark moment on the ward, you might have
I looked this up, I realized that one of these babies had not just lived moments, had lived a year. And I thought that some crazy medical person might think of putting a tube in the stomach directly, would have to go through the abdominal wall to keep the baby alive. And that would have been so terrible that I thought that maybe I should do something. Now, a lot of people out there have come to the idea that it's just not possible. There's always something you can do. When I posted this blog, I asked for any of the now 25,000 people who have viewed this blog, for any suggestions they would have had in retrospect, I would have been interested. And there were very few, and they came down to the same ones all the time. Sedating the baby, which makes no sense. This was a baby who was a week old. We would very likely have killed it. Giving the baby pain medication, which made no sense because the baby was not in pain. Or giving IVs to maintain the baby's life for another period of a few days or a few weeks.
Let's separate out the two big ethical issues here. One is the decision to allow the baby to die or to not treat the baby, which is what you've described right there, which is one ethical issue. It sounds from what you're saying that it was fairly clear that the baby did not have the capacity to sustain its own life. This baby was going to die. But then there's the other question of you had the experience of holding the baby. You had the experience of seeing the baby. You had the traumatic experience of watching the baby die and of thinking through all of these questions in those 13 days. The individual who did not have that experience, though, is the mom. Is it right for a doctor to have made that decision to deprive that mother of that experience?
I think it is a debatable issue, and I have thought differently about it at different times. In the imminence, in the overwhelming experience of holding this child, I thought nothing could be worse for this mother. Even though she would have wanted to see the child, nothing could have been worse for her than seeing this baby. Now, of course, first of all, the standards have somewhat changed, the ethical standards. And I think the parents do, of course, have a right. He was violating their right. We knew that at the time. It was violating their right.
It was their experience.
It was their experience.
Their experience.
And he subtracted that. I mentioned that in the blog, blog, that he was violating their rights at that time. Now, the issue is, are there ever occasions when that should happen? And I thought initially in the moment that was the right thing to do. Now, time has passed. I think that most people would have opted to see the child. Mm.
You know, this impulse of doctors to protect and to calculate that a certain experience would be so damaging, and you've used those words, is almost irresistible, I think, in the healthcare profession. I mean, you're about healing.
It's an everyday experience. Yeah.
Yet, isn't life about irrevocable change? Isn't life about experiences which push us to limits that we can't imagine until we get there?
What I was trying to indicate in this blog is that there are experiences that are so peculiar in their character, so distinctive, so unexpected, that the usual rules break down and that people are finally left with the idea, what is the right thing to do in this situation? Now, a number of people have read this blog and are angry at me.
Why are they angry?
Well, I think they're angry for a number of reasons. First of all, there is a certain group out there that I really didn't know existed who are disabled, they feel with good reason that they have been persecuted and treated badly because they're disabled or disfigured in some kind of way.
Or they're scared that some doctor is going to decide someday, that experience, not being able to walk is.
But judging from what they have told me on the blog, what they're really upset is the fact that they are not treated like human beings in some situation. I'm sympathetic to that, and I feel terrible that they see me now as almost the incarnation of those evil people. Someone who looks at a child who's deformed and decides that this child should die on his own initiative. So I understand that. I'm a little disappointed because this child is so far different from their experience that I really never even anticipated that they would think that.
Is there a way to say, even stipulating, that the experience you're describing of this child is so far removed from a disability, quadriplegia, paraplegia that I experience, even disabilities that come close to pushing this edge? This child is way on the other side of that in your experience. But nevertheless, is there some sort of slippery slope argument that goes through people's minds that if doctors can make a decision autonomously on this, that someday they may get around to making it on something else?
Not only that, I mentioned in the blog that there are people, and one particular person, who makes this decision arbitrarily and unreasonably. I was making rounds on the ward, and there was a 70-year-old woman who had not had anything to eat for 2 or 3 days. So I ordered fluids. I had an ordinary conversation with her, and I ordered fluids. And the doctor who was in charge, her private doctor, called me up the next day in a huff. He said, what were you doing? I didn't order any fluids. And I said, well, she hadn't had any fluids. I hadn't anything to eat for 2 or 3 days. And he said, for God's sake, she's 70 years old. It's time to go.
Wow.
So even in those days, there were people, you know, there was a judgment that doctors made all of the time and still do, that this person is so sick, is suffering so much, is so in such a hopeless situation that maybe without telling anyone, they'll, slow down the drip. They'll cut away at medication. They'll add a certain amount of sedation with the understanding that the patient may very well die. That goes on. That will always go on. And it's one of those things that people should know.
What is this tension in a doctor between control and mercy? It seems to me they're together, but they're really at odds.
I don't think the doctors I know find themselves in these situations comfortably. They do not. No one I know wants to be placed in that situation. They do it because it seems to them sometimes there is no alternative. But getting back to this Cyclops child, it's true. You know, it's not just disabled people. Every human being has an experience of a sick child or an elderly parent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a live situation and a live problem. What I would like, one of the reasons I wrote this blog, is I wanted people to be able to think that maybe the way they thought about things might sometimes break down in certain situations. So I would say, well, what about this terrible situation? Do you still feel this way? Yes, I still feel this way. Well, what about this when this happens? Do you still feel this way? And they say, yes, they feel that way. And what I was trying to present is a situation which defied all of those plans and expectations and moral judgments. And someone is left with a kind of existential feeling about what should I do in this situation? And I don't pretend actually that I know or knew then what was right. What I would like people to know is that there is room for uncertainty and doubt. But a lot of people, this is a very simple matter. The Bible says this, and that's the end of the story.
Do you feel in your life there's room for doubt?
Well, it comes across all the time with patients. Now I'm a psychiatrist, so I don't have to deal with end-of-life issues so often, but of course I do. I'll give you an example. These things are so odd. I was asked to see a patient who was dying, had cancer, and she wanted more medication. She was in considerable pain. And I was asked to see her because if she wanted the higher dose of medicine to kill herself, she wasn't allowed to get it. But if she was allowed the higher dose of medication for pain, even with the expectation that it might kill her, she was allowed to do that. So I interviewed her. She expressed herself very clearly. She said, look, I know I'm going to die in a week or two. I don't care if I die a day earlier. I just don't want to die in pain. And so she was able to get the medication and, as a matter of fact, did die a few days later. So there are all of these conundrums that come up that no one can imagine until they are in the middle of it. And it happens to family members, and the family members are even less prepared than doctors to deal with this.
Did you ever try to reach out to the mom of that Cyclops
child? Oh, no. I never knew who the mom was.
What if she was sitting right here? What would you say about the experience that you had holding her baby that she didn't have?
Well, all I can tell her is obviously a mother holding a baby is different than a stranger holding a baby. But it was not a comfortable experience. It was hard to see this baby as a baby. So I am not interested in pursuing this woman who undoubtedly is dead now. This happened 52 years ago.
Yeah, no, I understand.
But I would not want to pursue it. Now, when I was on the ward, some things, untoward things happened. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this. This child had, among its other deformities, an extra finger. And the resident who was in charge of the ward, he said, treat the child's finger. And I said, well, why? The child is going to die anyway. And he said, look, it's a learning experience. It's practice. You might as well make some good out of it. I don't know what I expected, to be perfectly frank. There was something about the child lying there quietly that did not look like a child. In any case, the way you treat an extra finger is by tying a ligature around the base and pulling very hard. And I don't know what I expected. The finger was inoperable. I don't know if there were any nerves there. But what happened was the child screamed.
Oh, my God.
And I was suddenly taken aback that I had caused this pain stupidly and cruelly without really anticipating it. It was not callousness on my part. It was stupidity, ignorance.
Did anyone have the impulse during those 13 days to give that baby a name, or did it have a name?
You know, the baby did not have a name, I don't remember it ever coming up. Now, one of the things that people objected to is that I used the word monster. I used it in parentheses. I think it's a terrible name. But that was the medical term for this condition. And the other thing they complained about is I referred to it as it. A couple of reasons. I suppose it might be true that it allowed me a little bit to be a little easier treating the child or taking care of the child to think that it wasn't a human being, really. I tried to tell myself that. And I say that, as a matter of fact, in the blog. Of course, the big reason I called it is I have no memory of what sex it was. Mm. So this was a child that had no name, no sex, no ordinary existence. And yet, of course, it did have an existence. And voicing those kinds of thoughts is very upsetting to a lot of people, that this child was treated not as a child, but as a thing in some kind of way. And yet there is some element of truth to that.
Do you remember the moment the baby died?
I remember the baby at the moment I discovered the baby to be dead, yes. I felt relief. I felt sadness, of course. But it was awful for the child. It's hard to imagine a child that is not comforted by picking it up, that you can't feed it when it's hungry. You can't do anything for it, and it's an uncanny experience. And I've never had anything like that since then.
You know, I'm struck that, you know, here you are, bottom of the food chain in that ward, having this experience, thinking about all these judgments. At the beginning of your career, and you go on to be a psychiatrist, did this baby give you an extraordinary gift as a doctor to have had this experience so early in your career?
Well, if so, I would have preferred being spared that experience.
Really? Well, I can't have the images that you have. But I think anyone who's read that blog or who's heard your story find it very difficult to forget this story and what you've shared. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Dr. Frederick Newman is director of the Anxiety and Phobia Center at White Plains Hospital.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.